Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. My name is Graham. I'm an alcoholic and chairperson of today's meeting. We open AA meetings with a serenity prayer, and I invite you to join me. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Today we've got the AA home group from Plymouthton, and if you'd like to introduce each of yourselves.
Hi, I'm Janine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Janine.
Mandy, alcoholic.
I'm Mandy.
My name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah. I'm Peter. My name's Peter, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
And I'm David. I'm an alcoholic.
And if I could get Peter to read how it works from the big book, pages 58 to 60.
Thanks, Graham. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thanks, Peter. We're moving into the sharing part of the meeting now, and I'm going to ask each fellow to share. So I'll kick us off with Peter Kay.
Thank you, Graham. My name is Peter, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
And very nervous, alcoholic. Always do. I've been coming for many years, and I don't know what it is, but I still feel nervous. Anyway, I started drinking when I was 14, and I had my 44th birthday in a treatment centre. So basically, I drank for 30 years. And I had my last drink was on the 12th of May 1991. And on the 13th of May 1991, I went into a treatment centre. And I didn't know what I'd let myself in for. It was quite a frightening experience. And prior to that, at work, I was getting into more and more difficulties through my drinking. I worked at a university. And what a great place to work if you want to drink. There were 7 different bars in the campus, and so I could go from one to another. But my immediate boss could see something was wrong and persuaded me to go for assessment at a treatment centre. And I always remember that. I went there with my wife and son, and one of the people took my wife and son into a room, and this person, which turned out to be a counsellor, with a clipboard, said, "Right, Peter," he said, "let's talk about your drinking." And I said, "No." He said, "Why do you think you're here?" I said, "Because of her next door. She drives me barmy." And he just looked at me and he said, "Well, Peter, it's a catch-22 situation. Do you drink because your home life is bad, or is your home life bad because you drink?" He said, "I can't answer that, but I can help you take alcohol out of the equation." And we carried on. And then I got a letter saying that they suggested as soon as possible I went in for detox and rehabilitation for a minimum of 6 weeks. And in fact, I ended up staying 8 weeks there. And when I left, I still can remember this clearly. My key worker gave me a big hug. And she said, "Well done, Peter, 8 weeks without a drink." And I thought, wow, I couldn't go 8 hours without a drink prior to that. And as she gave me this hug, she said, "Peter, just keep getting to meetings and the rest will follow." Because the treatment centre was based on the 12 steps, etc. And we went to 2 meetings a week. And when I left there, I was petrified. How was I going to cope with life? Just frightened, completely frightened. And but she said, "Get to meetings." So I got to meetings. And the bit where she said, "And the rest will follow," at that moment in time, I didn't understand. But I realised as time went on, the rest was getting a home group, working the steps, getting a sponsor. And as I said, I don't know why, speaking to a microphone, I get very nervous. Anyway, so I started going to meetings, and
It was amazing. My first 2 years, I had a lot of problems with home life. And eventually my wife and I split up and things calmed down a bit. And I always remember going out with a friend of mine after my wife and I split up. And he said to me, "Are you going to have a beer now?" And he said, "We all knew it was your wife that sent you to the drink. And now she's gone, you're a happier person, you're more relaxed. Surely you can have a drink." And I found myself saying, "I don't know, Dave. What I do know, I've gone 2.5 years without a drink. Why change it?" And he said, "Fair enough." And that was that. And, you know, I love AA because without AA, I wouldn't be alive today. I know that. I would have either died of an accident or liver and kidney failure, the way I was treating my body. And what I like about AA is the sense of belonging. I always wanted, as I grew up, to be part of something, and I never could find. And then when I started going to the pubs at 14, how I got away with it, I don't know, because in the UK you have to be 18, but I did. And I got to know people, and I thought, this is it. And then when I stopped drinking, I thought, what am I going to do now? It's, as it says in the big book, am I going to be resigned to a life boring and glum like some self-righteous people I know? And I really thought it was going to be like that. But I can say all these years later, it's been anything but that. For one, I'm the other side of the world. It's a fantastic new life I had after 15 years of sobriety and carried on here. And one thing that reminds me, thing for me, I need to go to meetings to hear how people handle life. I still struggle with handling life. And by going to meetings and I hear people sharing things, it locks in my mind and it pops up later on. And example, it's two quick examples. One, there was a woman who used to go to my local meeting who had spent many years in Melbourne, and she kept saying how she struggled in England with the meetings and that the people weren't as friendly as they were in Melbourne. And I felt like saying, "Well, go back to Melbourne," but with stronger words. And when I came to New Zealand, I struggled. The message is the same, but the format of the meetings, and I struggled to start with. And the other thing was, just before I left the UK, I met a woman. She sat next to me at a meeting. I didn't recognise her. And I said, "Oh, are you new?" And she said, "Well, this time." She said, "I had X years sobriety. I moved to a different area, felt I didn't fit in, thought after all these years I don't need the meetings. I stopped going. Something happened and I picked up a drink." And when I came here, as I said, there was I struggled not to criticise New Zealand's way of meetings. And also, it crept into my head after 15 years, do I need the meetings? And I remembered that woman sharing, so I stuck to the meetings, and I'm still here today. And after 4 years here, my wife and I separated, and it blew me away. And I thought, well, what do I do now? Go back to the UK, what? And this little voice in my head said, because I have no family here, you've got the biggest family going, that the Fellowship of AA. And the people from my home group, which is Plymouth, where I've come from today, they text me, they phoned me, they basically looked after me and kept me going through those difficult periods. And I've moved on from there. And I am a very grateful member. And the other thing I like, it says that we'll have a life beyond our wildest dreams. Well, in my drinking days, my wildest dreams was lots of money, a fast car, etc., etc. Now I realise I've got it, and that is peace of mind. Going to bed of a night time and not waking up thinking, shit, I don't remember, how did I get here? Or, oh my God, I shouldn't have said that at work. or, you know, being at peace and sleeping through the night and waking up and not dreading meeting people that I'd offended, etc., etc. And I'm running out of time. The thing I love about AA is a lot of these little statements, like the person who drank will drink, and if nothing changes, nothing changes. I couldn't understand that in the beginning, but I now realise for me that it's doing the steps causes this change, and I needed to change, because without that, as it said, the person who drank will drink. And I came close after about a year of not drinking. I came home from work and my wife accused me of drinking. And I went ballistic. I stuck my arm out. I said, take some blood out of my arm. Get it analysed. There's no alcohol in me. And I thought, I'll show you what drinking is. And I went upstairs to get changed. And this little voice in my head said, you do realise she wants you to drink. And I thought, yes, well, I'll show you, I won't. And I didn't. And I was so grateful that I had this, because I could have easily picked up. And the other thing that used to be in my head was, why did I have to wait so long? Why did I have to wait till I was 44 before I started this new journey? And why didn't I come in like younger, like some people I know? What I realise now is I had to get to that rock bottom point for me. And so when I did stop, I stayed stop. I think if I'd come in 5 years earlier, I most probably would have gone back out. I don't know. But I do know that whatever happened was the right time for me. And as it says, you know, God can stand for, G-O-D can stand for gift of desperation. And that's what I had. I was definitely another thing in the big book, sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was hating all that. And I just cannot believe where time has gone. All those, you know, one day led to a week, led to a month, led to years, and now many years. And I am truly grateful. And I don't know how time is going. I've run out of things to say, so I'll give up now. Thank you. Thank you, Graham.
Thanks, Peter. If you're listening, this is the AA meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. And if you're thinking you'd like to find out some more about AA, there's an 0800 number, which is 0800 229 675. That's available 24 hours, 7 days a week. And our website is www.alcoholics, ALCOHOLICS - anonymous, anonymous.co.nz. And on that website is a wealth of information. It has meetings. You can find a AA meeting anywhere in New Zealand. There's lots of other information you can find out to see if, I'm going to carry on with the sharing now. I'll ask Mandy to share. Mandy.
Oh, thank you. Mandy, alcoholic. Lovely to be here, clean and sober and not with the hangover. And, yeah, it was not like that at the end of my drinking. As the previous speaker said, I was completely burnt out. I'd come back around the world with a backpack full of old clothes. Nobody really wanted me around. I was a bit like a hot potato. You know, you have her, no, you have her. Oh, we can't deal with her. Oh, she's out of control. And I was just rotting in a bedroom, basically, putting cigarettes out on the floor, not answering the phone, not going to the letterbox. And just a nightmare, basically. I'd just alcohol was my master. And, you know, there's a bit in the big book that says, you know, quicksand stretched about me in all directions. And that's what it felt like. I just, you know, and yet I still wanted to continue to drink. You know, that's the crazy thing about being a sick, untreated alcoholic woman, is that all of that can go on, and I still want to drink because it's the solution. It's not the problem. And I was so steeped in denial when I was finally kind of ripped out of that situation, with a mental health officer coming round and assessing me, and going to the local doctor, and then ending up at the Drug and Alcohol Centre in Adelaide Road in Wellington. It all happened quite sort of quickly. But I came to AA, which was one of the requirements. And I just sat there like a lump of concrete. Really, nothing was going in and nothing was going out. And I saw the stuff on the walls. And I just thought, oh, I can't change, you know. This is just who I am, you know. This is my identity. You know, I take drugs, I drink, I smoke, I travel the world. I've got different passports, I've got different names. I dye my hair, I change, you know, my name. I do, you know, like I'm just this chameleon in and out of people's lives with no sense of belonging, and just relying on strangers and dumping myself on sort of people that I barely knew, and kind of looking for someone to take care of me, I guess. And, you know, suddenly I had to, you know, look at myself, put the spotlight on myself, get sober. You know, I didn't know what that meant, you know, stopping drinking. You know, it was just, you know, just the denial was so great, really, that it took me a couple of years coming in and out of AA, drinking and going to meetings to finally get that surrender that is spoken about, you know, that complete defeat and the recognition that inwardly that I was an alcoholic and that my life was completely unmanageable by me. I knew it was unmanageable. It had been ever since I picked up the first drink, but the powerlessness took me a while to understand, and I didn't realise that when I picked up the first drink, it set off an allergy and I couldn't stop drinking. It was like this salt water thirst. I needed more, not less. I felt in control, not out of control. You know, I had the opposite effect to normal drinkers that have a few drinks, feel a bit giddy and a bit out of control and stop and have a glass of water. That has not been my experience. And, you know, like the longer I've stayed around AA, the more I realise I know very little about the disease of alcoholism, about how I operate in the world. I have a perception about myself that isn't always true. The little things get to me, you know, I seem to cope with the big things. So I have a mind that cannot process reality and a body that cannot process alcohol, and I'm spiritually bankrupt. So it talks about this being a spiritual program. So, you know, I need a spiritual solution because I was beyond human aid. And so for me, I've had to look at my agnosticism and, you know, I've lived in the bedevilments. You know, I've been a prey to misery and depression. I've felt useless, can't control my emotional nature. I'll say something I think's helping someone and it's just ruined that relationship for 5 years, not just 5 days. So I've had to watch that kind of emotional dishonesty that happens within me, and, you know, that's untreated alcoholism today. You know, it manifests in restless, irritable and discontent, and I need a spiritual solution, basically. So, you know, I've had to have conscious, continual contact with the God of my understanding that it talks about in the big book, and that's what I have to seek today to stay fit so I can turn up at work, so I can be disciplined, so I can have my lunch at 12, I can pay my bills, I can get a warrant for my car, I can show up at home, I can follow a cooking recipe, I will stop at the red light. You know, seems like normal things that people do, but these are things I did not do. And so, you know, they're little spiritual milestones. And, you know, I'm just incredibly grateful to be here, know what my problem is today, and I know where the solution is. And I'll keep coming back, and thanks for asking me to share.
Thanks, Mandy. You're listening to Alcoholics Anonymous on air. This is a meeting that we run every 4 weeks. And if you think you might need help and you want to find out if AA is for you, you can ring free call on 0800 229 6757, or you can go onto the website, which is alcoholics.anonymous.co.nz, and there's lots of information on there, and we list all the meetings that are available in New Zealand for AA, so you can find a meeting any time of the day. So we will continue with the sharing now, and if I can ask Peter D to share. Thanks.
Thanks, Graham. My name's Peter and I'm an alcoholic.
Okay, Peter.
My journey began, so as a kid I didn't really feel like I fitted in. I felt awkward, I fought with people, and just felt generally ill at ease in myself. And then at 15, I drank. I'd nibbled, but it was the first time I'd really gone out and drunk properly. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. That I felt a release that I'd never experienced before. And I spent basically the next 13 or 14 years of my life trying to chase that euphoria that I had that night. Over a very short space of time, I basically evolved into drinking while I was at school, 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week. I played golf and I drank basically with the adults that I was playing golf with, and they accepted basically that we were able to drink in the same way that they drank, and that suited me just fine. That one of the things that I was proud of was that while I may not have achieved very well academically or sporting wise, I was a good drinker. I was able to hold my drink, and I felt like a man, and that made me feel just, you know, a part of something that I'd never felt part of before. The other thing that I was good at doing was that I needed money to buy booze, and so I developed a good work ethic. So I had a lot of part-time jobs, because, you know, unfortunately my parents didn't quite see the good sense in providing me with an ample amount of money for me to go and drink myself stupid. And so that period of my life was still traumatic, and that I didn't really get on that well with my family. But there was that other side of my life where I was able to drink and have a sense of release and not really worry about all the things that had bedeviled me up until that point. I left home in a big storm, walked out of the house, ranting and raging, left my hometown, came down to Wellington, and I thought this was going to be a new start and I would not get into the trouble that I got into in my youth. But within a very short period of time, I think within a month of being in a hostel, I was kicked out because my drinking was unacceptable. And I can tell you that you probably had to exert yourself quite strenuously to achieve that honour. I think probably it was more that the matron didn't like me, but basically my drinking was obnoxious, and the people in the hostel didn't really want me around. And in a way, that was almost like a freedom. I think in the first year that I was down in Wellington, I think I had about 13 places that I slept in, either for a week or a couple of weeks or for longer periods, but I was constantly on the move. And it didn't really seem like a big deal to me, but it was a big deal to, seemed to be a big deal to everybody around me. So at a very, very young age, I came to the notice of my employers, who didn't quite know what to do with me, because all the other young cadets that they had were all being well behaved and whatever else, and I was just a constant problem. I think I was good at my job, and I was quite quick to pick up, you know, what I needed to do, but my behaviour and the way that I interacted with people in the workplace was difficult. Not all the time. There were some people that I got on really, really well with, but for the majority of my time in the workforce, it was difficult. And then I got drunk one night. There was somebody that I was dancing with, and so I asked her to marry me. And then she got excited, and not quite sure why, but she did. And then the next thing, we were talking to her parents, and I was thinking, my God, you know. So as I sort of came to in the morning and realised that I'd actually gone, you know, I didn't have the courage or the maturity to actually say, no, this was a terrible drunken, you know, sort of request, and I didn't really mean it, and I didn't really have the guts to pull out. And I but that determined the fate of my life. And so, you know, it's not much more than a teenager. I was married, and you know, and that was there were two very positive things about that. So one is that I had somebody that was keeping an eye on me and criticising and commenting on my drinking on a daily basis. And the second thing was that I had an endless supply of money. So if there had been any financial constraints on my drinking up until that point, they were removed because I had a second income to spend. and I did that with a lot of, I was very, very good at spending my wife's income on my drinking. And I suppose it was about not long after that I got a very good job and I got a big pay increase. And again, I was working with people that were much older than me, and these were the hardened drinkers in the real estate industry. And I really enjoyed the fact that this was a generation of people who drank even harder than the people at the golf club. And they liked me because I drank the way they did, and I liked them because, you know, so none of us felt uncomfortable with the fact that we were just total pussheads. I was trying to live a life, and in the workforce, I was actually capable of working through and managing the delivery of the product, you know, so that wasn't necessarily a big challenge for me. I didn't get stressed so much by the work. What I got stressed by was the interaction with people. I could deal with people that I was meeting on a one-off basis, you know, clients that I only met and only probably knew for a maximum of a week. But it was the people that I had to deal with on an ongoing basis. I really was estranged from my family of birth, probably to some extent, more because I just couldn't be bothered making the effort to catch up with them. They didn't really drink the way I drank. And so my wife copped most of it, and she didn't have a drinking problem. And so when we were younger, we would go out and drink together. But as the marriage went on, after 2 or 3 years, she became sick and tired of this pissed husband who was unreliable in every way, shape and form. I drank and drove, and I'm not proud of that. I would wake up in the morning and not have any idea where I was. I would look at the ceiling, and if it was the ceiling that I recognised, then that probably meant I was at home. If it was a ceiling that I didn't recognise, then it probably meant I was in trouble in one way, shape or form. I would sometimes wake up, know that I was at home, but then not remember how I got home. And so there would be that horrible creeping down to the garage to see whether the car was there. And then if the car was there, whether there was any damage to it, because I was increasingly having times when I couldn't remember what had happened the night before. And I didn't really think That was particularly difficult. I didn't know whether other people had that experience or not. About 24, I remember thinking to myself, like, this is all a bit crazy, and I would drink till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd go home. I'd get up early with a minimum amount of sleep, feeling like shit. Trawl my way into work. Do my work, but then at around about 11 or 12 o'clock the blinds would come down because the effects of the alcohol were starting to wear off and I wouldn't be able to do anything. I would just, yeah, until I had another drink. The moment I had another drink, then it would be like a reset and things would be, you know, better. And that was my pattern. I would do that, start drinking again around about 5, because if you drank before 5, then that was a pattern, that was an indicator that you had a problem with booze, and I certainly didn't have a problem with booze. I had a problem with a nagging wife, and I had a problem with the fact that I didn't earn as much money as other people, and I had a problem with lots and lots of things, but I didn't have a problem with booze. So I went along and I looked at this person that I'd arranged to meet from AA, and they looked like an ancient bloody, you know, sort of decrepit, derelict person, and I couldn't relate to them. And so I sat there and watched, making up my mind as to whether I was going to cross the road and say hello to them or whether I was just going to observe them. I observed them and went back out and spent the next 4 years trying to work out how to stop drinking on my own account. And I would sometimes do it for a month, sometimes for 3 months. But each time I relapsed, it would be with this huge sense of, you know, relief and but it was this constant battle. So what happened for me was that my wife had stopped going out with me anywhere. She stayed at home and basically lived her life and didn't want to be anywhere with me. I was getting into increasing amounts of trouble at work because I would go away on work trips and forget to come home. And my bank balance was shrinking because I was spending an increasing amount of our family income plus a good chunk of the bank's on my drinking habit. And I had an uncle that came to stay, and this guy was the family drunk. You know, every family's got a drunk, I suppose, and this guy was our drunk. And he basically took me aside and gave me a real toweling down, you know, as sort of the older generation did back in the day. And I thought, you bloody prick. I said, you're staying in my house as my guest and you've got the temerity to come and tell me what I am and aren't and not doing well. And I thought he was just a prat. But I had sat and listened and he had unsettled me and he'd made my drinking uncomfortable. So he'd taken the bloody joy out of it because, anyway... About 4 or 5 months later, my world was falling to bits. I was running a project that was in chaos. I was trying to build a relationship with another woman that wasn't my wife because I was sure that was probably, you know, one of the root causes of most of my problems. And I had financial problems like up the wazoo and I didn't know how to get out of them. And I didn't really know what to do. And I said to my wife, I think I've got a problem with the booze. And I didn't really mean it. And I didn't really expect what was to come. But what I didn't know was that my wife had been in touch with Al-Anon and they had told her to sit and wait for me to say those words. And then I was, you know, cutting a long story short, I was wheeled in to see a counsellor. And this guy had my measure. He was one of us. He knew where I was coming from and he knew exactly how to handle me. And I'd spent my life wrapping people around my little finger with guile and bullshit and absolute dishonesty. And this guy didn't have a bar of it. You know, long story short, within about 2 weeks I was in a rehab. And I quite liked the fact that everybody wanted to talk about me. You know, that was fantastic, you know. But the thing I didn't like was the fact that everybody else seemed to be working out what their problem was and what this program was about. And I didn't understand it in the least bit. So I came out of treatment and I was on probation at work. I was on probation at a home. But I didn't want to work this program in the way that it's written out in these steps. I went up to Hong Kong doing a bit of a geographical, and that helped me to get out of the financial shit that I was in. It was a bit of a fresh start. But after about a year up there, my life was no different from what it had been back in New Zealand. And then somebody said to me, look, if you want what we've got, why don't you do what we've done? And I thought that was the most outrageous suggestion. I thought it was rude, actually, because, you know, like, couldn't they see that I was this paragon of, you know, sort of a model of an AA member? And eventually I realised that this person was right, and they'd given me a gift, and that's when I started working the steps. And so for me, I got a sponsor. The sponsor took me through the steps. I listened, learnt, and started to realise that this was a simple program. It wasn't as complicated as I thought it was, and it was a powerful program, and it was a program that could move me from living with resentments and fears and anxiety up the wazoo into living a life where I could have a sense of peace and direction and could feel like I was achieving. One of the things that happened to me in the process was that I read a paragraph in the big book, which I'm going to read out, which is called The Promises. And I read this, when I first read this, I thought, my God, I mean, like, how could I have read the big book? How could I have been around this long and never heard this paragraph? But this paragraph expressed everything that I felt that I'd been looking for in my life. And it said, and it reads, and it's halfway through the part in the big book that talks about step 9. And it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the road, the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialise if we work for them. So that paragraph really hit home with me because I think underneath my rebellion, I think that I was somebody that wanted to make a difference. I did care about the world. You know, I had good values, and I wanted to live in the way that those promises were suggesting. And what I've been around a long time now. My sobriety date is the 17th of September 1979. So if you do your quick maths on that, that's like going back a few generations. So I've had the privilege of living virtually my whole adult life in the program. Sometimes people say to me, like, and you still go to meetings? Yeah, I do. I still go to meetings because I enjoy it, because the people in the meetings are my tribe. But I think I go to meetings because I hear enough stories to recognise that people that stop focusing on a recovery-based approach and on working the steps are at risk of relapsing. They may not always do that, but if they do relapse, then basically they will go back to living the life that they lived before they came into recovery. They'll go back to handling situations because alcohol is a powerful beast, and that once we taste it again, then it promises to take away all of our problems. And that's a false promise, but that's basically, so that's really the reason. I have a simple view on spirituality. I believe that it's about me being.
Mm-hmm.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.